You're listening to part 2 of episode 590 of Unwelcome Guests. We now switch the focus from food to medicine, another area where it seems like a lot of expensive research is missing the point, because expensive research is designed around making money, selling products to people. What if a lot of the modern medical procedures turn out to be not only useless, but actually counterproductive and damaging? That central question formed the thesis of Ivan Illich's Medical Nemesis, in which he stated that the modern medical system had become a threat to health. On the face of it, it's a contradiction in terms. If you define the modern medical system as that system designed to produce health, but what is health? It's wholeness. Wholeness is that to be achieved through the refining of chemical substances which don't exist in nature, and then adding them to the body, substances which, because they're not naturally occurring, the body has not been prepared for. We know that drug companies are looking for substances which don't exist in nature, and then they can claim to have invented them. How did medical practices which go back hundreds or thousands of years get to be relegated to alternative medicine, with the presupposition being proper medicine involves the use of these modern drugs? Well, these are just my reflections on the health system. We won't be touching on them in this program, but we are going to hear about the placebo effect, something of an embarrassment for drug companies, one of the glitches in the modern matrix about how human beings are basically just biological machines, which, in order to run well, need to have the correct balance of chemical inputs. As is the case with food and digestion, this isn't flat out wrong, but on its own, it's a very misleading perspective, as we shall hear. And this is two programs by Ben Goldacre, which I've run together from the UK's Radio 4.
Placebos can be ointments, they can be capsules, they can be surgery. There are trials in which they just open the patient up, close them up again, and don't do the surgical intervention. And that's in order to find out whether the real surgery is doing anything beyond the placebo effect.
The nicer you are to your patients and the more optimistic you are about their treatment, the more likely they are to get some kind of benefit.
It's not just handing a pill like you're throwing feed to a chicken in a chicken coop, but it's actually the pill, the medication, is part of an elaborate drama, and that drama has an impact on people's illness and health.
I think the attitude of most people is, I don't care what it is or how it works. If it makes me feel better, bring it on.
This is a program filled with improbable results, and in many respects, the placebo effect should be an outrage to science and medicine. We flatter ourselves that treatments are specific to the diseases that we're treating, that it's all about molecules, and then suddenly along comes a placebo pill with no ingredients, no actual medicine, that seems to work, relieve pain, improve mood, even treat Parkinson's disease, inducing changes in the brain. I'm Ben Goldacre, and over the next two programmes I'll be exploring the idea that beliefs and expectations can affect our health and well-being. And I'll also be considering the implications of this for doctors and for medicine as a whole. But we'll begin in the 18th century with a doctor from Connecticut. Elisha Perkins was a genius, or at least a very wealthy man, selling thin metal rods which he called Perkins tractors, a miraculous device that you waved over bits of the body to cure gout, rheumatism and all kinds of other ailments. They worked, he claimed, by drawing off the noxious electrical fluid that lies at the root of all suffering. And there were lavishly printed pamphlets promoting these Perkins tractors, filled with testimonials from satisfied customers.
Sir, a neighbour of mine, Mr. James Connor, was sorely afflicted with an inflammation in his left eye. The eye appeared like a ball of blood, and all the contiguous parts were much inflamed and of a bloody colour. I saw your metallic tractors applied to the affected part with such success that in the space of about 10 minutes he declared the pains were gone. He has told me since he never felt any inconvenience from it afterwards. Reverend Stephen B. Balch, Georgetown, May 16th, 1797.
News of these miraculous Perkins tractors spread rapidly around the world, and it wasn't long before someone decided to look into them. This was the Age of Enlightenment, and British physician John Haygarth was very much a man of his time, one of the first doctors to think methodically about collecting evidence for the things that doctors do, rather than simply relying on received wisdom. He proposed a carefully controlled test of the Perkins tractors to see whether or not they worked as claimed.
Prepare a pair of false, exactly to resemble the true tractors. Let the secret be kept inviolable, not only from the patient, but every other person. Let the efficacy of both be impartially tried. The cases should be accurately stated, and the reports of the effects produced by the true and false tractors be fully given, in the words of the patients.
Brilliantly, for the early 19th century, Haygarth is describing an example of what we'd now call a placebo-controlled blinded trial. It was controlled because there was a treatment group getting the real tractors and a comparison group getting something, placebo fake Perkins tractors, which was apparently the same thing, but missing the crucial, magic, noxious electrical fluid-sucking element. This is important, because there are lots of reasons why you might get better during any medical treatment, which often have nothing to do with the treatment itself. For one thing, all diseases have a natural history of their own, so people do just get better from colds or a gammy knee, your back pain comes and goes, and so on. But Haygarth's test was also blinded. The fake and real treatments looked identical, and so the patients had no way of knowing which they were getting. The results of one trial, using fake wooden tractors on a man unable to control his bladder, were reported by one of Haygarth's colleagues, Mr. Richard Smith, at the Bristol Infirmary.
The man was a poor, feeble subject who was willing to try anything. In 1 minute, after the points of the wooden tractors had been drawn in various directions about the pelvis, he said, "I begin to feel something jumping in my inside." Later he reported that he felt a smarting in his loins, and upon sitting down exclaimed, "I am better." It was demanded how he knew it. "When I used to sit down," said the man, "there was always a spirit of water thrown from me, but now I can prevent it."
In a series of trials, Haygarth had answered his question. These miraculous recoveries had nothing to do with Perkins' patented product. But rather than leave a vacuum, Haygarth was keen to think through what else might explain these patients getting better.
"I have long been aware of the great importance of medical faith. These trials place its efficacy in a very conspicuous point of view, and must even astonish persons who have particularly attended to this subject. They clearly prove what wonderful effects the passions of hope and faith, excited by mere imagination, can produce upon disease."
Perhaps Haygarth's patients were going to get better anyway. There's no way of being sure. But this was the beginning of something very important. Doctors thinking clearly around the impact of expectation and belief on health, what we would call the placebo effect. For a long time, the notion of studying this phenomenon was neglected, especially as the specific cures and magic bullets of modern medicine began to be discovered. But recently, there's been a resurgence of interest. Irving Kirsch, professor of psychology at the University of Hull, has been studying the placebo effect for many years, and he suspects that mental disorders like anxiety and depression may be particularly susceptible.
One thing is that they're mood disorders. They're disorders that involves a person's subjective feelings. Another, with depression in particular, one of the core features of depression is hopelessness. People who are depressed are feeling that they're in this terrible state of affairs, and they feel hopeless about ever getting better. So when you offer them a treatment that provides a promise of relief, a promise of benefit, of making better this terrible state of affairs, that instills a sense of hope, which is exactly the opposite of what depression is.
What evidence is there to support that? Because it's quite difficult to measure the size of a placebo benefit, isn't it?
You measure it the same way as you measure the size of a drug benefit. There are studies in which people have been put on a waiting list and followed up while other people were given either a drug or psychotherapy or a placebo. And if you want to know what the size of the placebo effect is, you compare how much improvement there is in the group that's getting the placebo to how much improvement or change there is in the group that's not getting any treatment at all.
Now, Irving, you've done research comparing the benefits of some antidepressant drugs with placebo sugar pills?
Well, in those studies, we found that the major part of the benefit that you get from the drug is, in fact, due to the placebo component, to the knowledge that you're getting a drug. In other words, people get better when they're given antidepressants, but they also get better when they are given placebos, and the difference between the two in clinical terms is not all that great.
Some people might find that result disappointing. But in some respects, it's also quite an encouraging finding, paradoxically, because it shows that people do improve simply with placebos. It suggests, perhaps, that we all have untapped reserves of resilience. Physical pain is another area where the placebo effect seems to be powerful, and there's a long history of extraordinary stories. Dr. Henry Beecher was working in a World War II field hospital when the morphine ran out and found he could operate on horrible injuries using only injections of salt water. To better understand the placebo response to pain, Irving Kirsch has performed an ingenious experiment using a fake anesthetic cream which he called Trivaricane.
What we did was to create pain by putting a metal bar on the index finger of the person's hand, and we did that on two fingers, on the left hand and on the right hand, and on one of those two fingers we put this placebo ointment, Trivaricane, and in the other we didn't. And so the placebo effect would be the difference in pain between the hand that got the treatment and the hand that did not. And what we have gotten in each of the studies that we have done is less pain when we've treated the finger with this placebo, Trivaricane, than when we have not.
And, of course, Trivaricane was such a potent treatment that people needed to wear gloves when they were applying it.
Of course, and they had to have white medical coats and little badges saying that they were medical researchers, everything to make it believable, because the heart of the placebo effect is a person's belief and expectations.
In some respects, it's not so surprising that beliefs and expectations can change how we feel, reducing anxiety or depression or diminishing our perception of pain. But can the placebo effect produce objectively measurable changes, changes that we can actually see in the body?
We know that placebos that are given to asthmatic patients, you have them inhale from a placebo inhaler, can either produce bronchodilation or bronchoconstriction, depending on what you say the drug is going to do. We know that we can increase heart rate, we can increase blood pressure with placebo caffeine. So all of these are things that happen not just in the mind, but also in the body.
But perhaps even those, intuitively, are outcomes where it's not outrageous to imagine that positive expectations might have an effect. We're all fairly familiar with the idea that blood pressure and heart rate respond to our emotional states. We've all had a brisker heart rate before an exam or in response to bad news. But here's a particularly dramatic example. Cecilia Linder is Professor of Cardiology at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. She was part of a team investigating the use of pacemakers to treat a condition called obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, a thickening of the muscle walls of the heart. Patients with this condition have difficulty pumping enough blood out to the body, and the symptoms include things like palpitations, chest pains, dizziness and dyspnea or shortness of breath. They were hoping that pacemakers would fool the heart into pumping more efficiently. Obviously, they wanted to test their proposed treatment against a placebo, a control group, to see if they worked any better. So in this case, some of the implanted pacemakers were switched off for 3 months, but without the patients knowing.
What we found was that we did have an overall positive effect by having the pacemaker turn on, both in terms of symptoms and quality of life. But what was surprising was that also during the 3 months when the pacemaker was actually turned off, we did see effect on chest pain, dyspnea, dizziness and palpitations. Those symptoms were significantly improved during inactive pacing. But even more surprising was that even the objective findings became better. The thickening of the heart became less during inactive pacing as well. So that means that there was a placebo both in terms of objective and subjective parameters.
In some respects, that's a completely outrageous finding. A pacemaker showing a benefit before it's even switched on. And like much of what we know about the placebo effect, it was almost an incidental finding, coming off the back of a trial looking at the effect of active pacemakers. So how could a pacemaker that switched off have such a measurable effect on the physiological functioning of the heart? This study didn't address that question. But Cecilia Linda speculates it might have something to do with a reduction in the hormones, known as catecholamines, that are related to stress.
We know that patients with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy are very susceptible to stress, and stress means the outflow of catecholamines. And if those hormones get out in the circulation, that induces the heart to contract in a less favorable way. So if stress went down, that meant less stress hormones and a better heart work.
So we've seen how patients can experience dramatic benefits from a placebo, as long as they believe that they're having a real treatment. But how about if it's the other way round? What if you're given a real physical treatment, but without your knowledge? Professor Fabrizio Benedetti from the University of Turin looked at just that, to establish how much of the response to a real drug is due to the placebo effect. Irving Kirsch.
He gives, in one case, morphine to patients intravenously, and sometimes he tells them when they're going to be getting the actual drug, and sometimes he doesn't. So sometimes they're getting morphine, and this is for postoperative pain, sometimes they're getting morphine knowing they're getting morphine, and sometimes they're getting morphine without knowing that they're getting morphine. And what he finds is that if patients don't know that they're getting morphine, it cuts the effect of the morphine in half. So about half of the effect of the real drug, in this case a powerful painkiller, morphine, appears to be a placebo effect.
So there's a placebo component to the benefit you get from real drugs like morphine, as well as from fake anesthetic creams or switched-off pacemakers. But to really unpick the factors behind a strong placebo response, the elegant thing to do is compare one placebo against another. This was done ingeniously by Professor Daniel Moorman, an anthropologist by training from the University of Michigan, with a special interest in medicine. He was looking at data from clinical trials of drugs to treat stomach ulcers. And because he was studying the placebo effect, he was only looking at the data from the control groups in these trials. That is, the people taking the inert, inactive, placebo sugar pills.
I had a suspicion that control group healing rates in these ulcer trials varied from place to place, and I didn't know what might have been causing that. And it occurred to me that I had these two groups of patients, all of whom had endoscopically diagnosed ulcers, all of whom took inert tablets for a month, some of them twice a day and some of them four times a day. And so I just looked at the outcome, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was the ones who had took two a day had an average of about 25% were healed by the end of the month, and the ones who took four a day, it was more like 36 or 38%. It was a statistically significant difference, and I think that just about anybody would consider that also to be a clinically significant difference.
So that's an extraordinary thing to have discovered, really. You found that four sugar pills a day clear ulcers better than two sugar pills a day.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, that's not the only study that's been done looking at the way a pill is presented.
There are a number of others. One of the nicest studies was one done in Britain. It was very large. It had 1,200 or 1,400 subjects. They were divided into four different groups. They were all women who said that they had headaches and that they treated them with over-the-counter analgesics, aspirin probably. And the four groups were comprised, two groups got aspirin and two groups got placebos. And one of the aspirin groups got aspirin that just said aspirin on it. The other aspirin group got aspirin tablets that had a very widely advertised brand name on it. The two control groups either got inert tablets labeled aspirin or inert tablets labeled with this famous brand name. And it turned out that the brand name aspirin worked better than the exact same aspirin without the brand name on it. And brand name placebo worked better than placebo without the brand name on it. The important thing to recognize that all of the patients who got aspirin got exactly the same aspirin. I mean, it was made by the same company in the same way, following, it just had different labels on it. So the thing is that it's not only the number of pills, but it's also what people know about the pills by watching the television.
It's a chastening finding for any skeptical scientist who's trying to persuade their friends that they're wasting money buying brand-name painkillers by arguing that they've got exactly the same molecules in them as supermarket-owned brand versions. Because actually, the believers are right. The drugs might be the same, but the expensive television ads actually make you feel better. And beyond the packaging, it even seems that something as simple as the colour of a pill can have an effect. Daniel Moorman again.
There was a study done some years ago in a medical school in the United States, young medical students were told that they had been enrolled in a study of some new drugs being worked on by the pharmacology department. And each student was given either one or two pink or blue inert tablets. And what they told them was that one of the drugs being tested was a stimulant and the other one was a sort of a depressant, a sort of like a sleeping tablet. And the way it turned out was that the people who took red tablets felt sort of invigorated and up, whereas the people who took blue tablets felt sort of sleepy and logy. Then there have been quite a few studies which have shown that red placebos or red pills tend to act as uppers and blues tend to act as downers.
But it would be wrong to get preoccupied with the idea of placebos as pills, because if they have no medicine in them, then the process of receiving and swallowing a pill is just symbolic, a ceremony or ritual like any other. Professor Ted Kapchuk from Harvard Medical School put this idea to the test. In an elegant study comparing two completely different forms of placebo, a pill and then a more elaborate pain-relieving ritual, modelled on acupuncture.
What we did was take 270 patients with persistent arm pain, the kind of thing you see people who use computers taping their wrists with braces and stuff, and we gave half of them sham acupuncture needles. It looks like an acupuncture needle. It feels like an acupuncture needle. The patient sees it go in, but actually goes up the shaft. And then we gave the other half a sugar pill. We told them they may get real acupuncture or placebo acupuncture. They may get amitriptyline, which is an old-fashioned antidepressant that's sometimes used for pain relief, or placebo. But in fact, for the first 2 weeks, we only gave people dummy needle, dummy pill. And at the end of the study, the dummy needle significantly reduced pain compared to the dummy pill, meaning that just the appearance of one kind of medical ritual gives a different effect in the appearance of another medical ritual.
And the greater benefit, we might reasonably suppose, is because acupuncture feels like a more dramatic intervention than
a
pill.
I think that's definitely one very clear possible interpretation. One of the nice things about that study is the sugar pill had a better effect than the acupuncture for sleep, meaning the ritual of taking a pill is probably better for sleeping. The ritual for pain relief is better with an acupuncture pin.
And is it reasonable to suppose that that's because we have different expectations about pills and about needles?
I think it's partly expectation, but I also think it's kind of an automaticness, maybe a conditioned response, where pills and sleeping and people who have insomnia often take sleeping pills, or that if you want to get rid of pain, a needle somehow is better. The other thing is that we know that animals have placebo effects, and that's not likely to be just cognitive expectation. There have been many experiments where rats are given sugar plus a drug and then later just given the drug. The sugar later on works like the drug. That's not an expectation. That's probably a conditioning response.
So in some respects, we might just be conditioning our bodies, responding to a pill like a cue in the same way that Pavlov's dog salivated in response to the dinner bell. Very little is known in this area, but it's incredibly tempting to speculate about what might be going on inside the body and the mind when we experience symptom relief from a placebo. Anthony Jones is Professor of Neurorheumatology at Manchester University, and he's one of a growing band of researchers trying to understand what's happening when people respond to placebos in the treatment of pain.
People find it quite hard to grasp that this may be a real physiological phenomenon, because you can only judge someone else's pain by what they're telling you. So we did a study to try to show that this was a real phenomenon by using techniques where we look at the brain's response to a painful laser stimulus on the skin.
They used a fake anesthetic cream, a bit like Irving Kirsch's Trivaricane. And again, they found that patients reported a reduction in pain when they had the placebo. But they also found a difference in the activity of some of the brain areas involved in the perception of pain. Anthony Jones believes this might give some insight into how the placebo response to pain is working.
What we found is that most of the placebo response seems to be mediated by a change in how you anticipate the pain that might be coming along. And we think what happens is that there's, if you like, a hierarchy in the brain, and that when you get a pain stimulus, that's being transmitted to a number of levels in the brain, and a number of those will say, this is all nasty, this is potentially a threat and painful, But then there are some higher levels in the brain, particularly in the frontal cortex, in these forebrain areas, and they are telling these lower levels that actually this is not painful. And so the brain does, to an extent, decide about what you're going to experience.
It's always hard to be sure how to interpret this kind of brain imaging research, because so much is unknown about the normal functioning of the brain anyway. But there's one study which feels tantalisingly close to the holy grail of placebo research. A placebo that produces in the body the same physical effects as the actual drug it's substituting for. Parkinson's disease is a movement disorder caused by patients having reduced levels of the neurotransmitter dopamine in a part of the brain which helps to generate movement. Dr. Sarah Lidstone and colleagues at the University of British Columbia measured the dopamine response to Parkinson's drugs using a brain imaging technique called positron emission tomography, or PET. Once again, at the outset, their study wasn't focusing on the placebo response at all.
We were interested in looking at the brain's dopamine response to different doses of a common medication that's given for Parkinson's. In this case, it's called apomorphine. And so the patients were given three different doses of the medication. And as a control, we had one injection that instead of being the active medication was saline, it was a placebo. So what we did was we measured the dopamine levels using PET for each of these different doses of the medication and also for a placebo. And we weren't expecting to find any increases in dopamine on placebo because these subjects have Parkinson's and their brains are depleted of dopamine. And instead, what we actually found was that following placebo injection, the subjects released substantial amounts of dopamine in their brains without any medication having been given. And these are patients, as you remember, who are depleted in dopamine. So it was quite a major finding, actually. We were very surprised.
Even better, for some of the patients, not only did a placebo injection increase the amount of dopamine, but it also improved their symptoms.
In this particular study, all of the subjects released substantial amounts of dopamine. However, only half of the subjects who were studied reported actually feeling subjective benefit. And it was those patients who said that they felt better. They said, you know, we feel much better. I feel like I have less stiffness in my joints. I can move faster. I feel more relaxed. It was those patients who said that they felt better who actually released higher levels of dopamine. So there was a link between their subjective perception of improvement in their symptoms and the amount of dopamine that was released in their brains.
By every possible measure of sense in the universe, this experimental result should be an outrage. An injection of nothing at all can induce a change in the brain which mirrors the effect of an injection of a proper anti-Parkinson's drug. But it's findings like these that require us to update our simplistic models of cause and effect in medicine. Placebos can relieve pain, relieve stress, even treat ulcers. Two sugar pills are better than one. Pink sugar pills are better stimulants than blue ones. Packaging enhances pain relief, and a dramatic placebo ritual is more effective than a quiet, humble sugar pill. None of this could have any pharmacological effect on the body. The question, of course, is where does the power lie? Dan Moorman.
The one thing that we can be absolutely sure of when we see somebody responding to a placebo is that it was not the placebo that did it. Placebos are inert. They don't do anything. But the fact remains that we see people taking placebos and we see they respond to them frequently. So what do? If it wasn't the placebo, what was it? And my argument is that the thing that is behind the effectiveness of these treatments is what the placebo means. It's the meaning of the drug. And the meaning of the drug is not just the pill. The treatment is the whole nine yards. It's the sign hanging on the wall showing you colon, you know, or the spine hanging from the doorknob at the chiropractor's office. It's the guy wearing the white coat. It's the stethoscope hanging out of the pocket. It's the diplomas hanging on the wall. You know, all of that stuff goes together to create this medical experience.
Medicine, of course, is an applied science. So there should be things we can take from this research into the placebo effect and exploit to improve medical practice. Perhaps we've neglected the ritual and the art of medicine in our excitement about molecules and magic bullets for individual diseases. Perhaps doctors, you might even argue, should be allowed to deceive their patients with sham operations and white lies about pills, anything if it helps the patient get better. Perhaps this could be a justification for alternative therapies as the acceptable face of placebo in the modern health marketplace.
The placebo effect has produced some of the most improbable experimental results in the whole of medicine. Two placebo sugar pills are better than one for clearing stomach ulcers. Blue sugar pills are better than pink for anxiety. Just a brand name on a packet of pills induces extra pain relief. And even sham operations or pacemakers that haven't been switched on can improve symptoms in serious medical conditions. We'll be exploring the implications for doctors and for medicine as a whole. What if a healthcare practitioner knows that their treatment is no more powerful than placebo, no more than theatre? The anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss tells the story of a man called Quesalid from the part of Canada known to us as Vancouver. Quesalid was a Native American, but he was also a sceptic. He thought his local traditional healers, the shamans, were quacks and frauds, but he also found them endlessly fascinating and wanted to understand the tricks of their trade. And so he went undercover. Lévi-Strauss describes the moment when Quesalid first witnesses the full drama of a shamanistic healing ritual.
The shaman hides a little tuft of down in a corner of his mouth, and then at the proper moment, after having bitten his tongue or made his gums bleed, he throws it up, covered with blood. He then solemnly presents it to his patient and the onlookers as the pathological foreign body extracted as a result of his sucking and manipulations. His worst suspicions confirmed, Quesalid wanted to continue his inquiry, but he was no longer free. His apprenticeship among the shamans began to be noised about, and one day he was summoned by the family of a sick person who had dreamed of Quesalid as his healer. The first treatment was an outstanding success. Although Quesalid came to be known from that moment as a great shaman, he did not lose his critical faculties. Instead, he interpreted his success in psychological terms. He carries on his craft conscientiously and takes pride in his achievements. He seems to have completely lost sight of the fallaciousness of the technique which he had so disparaged at the beginning.
Quesalid's approach raises interesting questions for medicine. He's aware of the role of theatre, the art of medicine. But as time passes, he seems more willing to exploit it, despite knowing that his rituals consist of little more than belief. Modern doctors are resistant to the idea of actively misleading their patients, but recent research has pointed more and more to the pivotal role of ceremony and the doctor in the healing process. Ted Kapchuk, associate professor at Harvard Medical School, has tried to dissect and examine these effects in a study on patients with irritable bowel syndrome receiving sham acupuncture, where the needles sting but don't actually penetrate the skin.
What we did was take 262 people with irritable bowel syndrome over a long time, and we randomized them to three different arms. In one arm, we did nothing. We just observed. That was our baseline. The second arm, the acupuncturist, because we use placebo acupuncture, went into the room and said, "Hi, my name is, I've read your charts, I know what to do, but for the rest of the experiment, I'm not allowed to talk to you because we're studying how acupuncture works and we don't want to confound it by a doctor-patient interaction." In the third group, patients were given sham acupuncture in the same way as the second group, but also we asked the acupuncturist to provide an optimal patient-doctor relationship. We had the acupuncturist express empathy. She would say, I actually understand what you mean. I have relatives with this illness. We asked the acupuncturist to express attentive listening. They would repeat words, ask questions more carefully. We asked the acupuncturist to express confidence. The acupuncturist say, "I'm really excited to be able to work in this experiment because I've had a lot of experience with this illness and acupuncture works." And what we got at the end of the six-week experiment was that the observation had a little positive effect. The limited, just the needle, had a bigger effect. And the third arm, the needle plus an optimal relationship, had this huge effect, which was at least as big, if not bigger, than any drug ever used for irritable bowel in any experiment previously done. Meaning an elaborate ritual could shift this illness in ways that it's very dramatic, clinically significant, and beneficial to patients.
Of course, there's no reason why these findings should only be applied to inactive placebo treatments. In the last program,
we heard about the work of Professor Fabrizio Benedetti at the University of Turin. He found that patients experienced far less pain relief from morphine when it was given without their knowledge. Irving Kirsch, Professor of Psychology at the University of Hull, says that Benedetti's work, and the results of the IBS study, which he also worked on, have important implications for doctors.
What it tells us is that the benefit of a treatment can either be enhanced or detracted based on how you treat the patients that you're dealing with, how you interact with them. And it also has very important ramifications for how physicians need to be trained in terms of their interpersonal style, what we call the bedside manner. I have two experiences that I can recall with physicians. One was a physician in New Jersey. Her name was Marnie, and she became our family physician. And one of the things that I can remember is that in every consultation, one is that she looked me in the eye, and the second is always, at least once during the visit, she would touch me just briefly on the arm. That conveyed a sense of caring, a sense of concern that I think is part of what made her an excellent physician. I've had other physicians who've just sat and looked at a computer screen while talking to me in a very matter-of-fact way, conveying a sense of, well, I'm doing my job, and you know, when you're gone, I'll do my job with the next patient, and I don't really care that much. So I think these things make a difference, and some people pay attention to them and others don't.
It's often tempting to castigate doctors for being bad at the communication element of their job, but there are so many ways to get it wrong, and there's even evidence that doctors can do harm by saying too much. Sir Ian Chalmers is co-author of the book Testing Treatments and has a long-standing interest in the evidence underpinning healthcare.
There's a view that patients should be told about all the risks associated with the treatments that are being offered to them and indeed of their disease. Patients vary, and some people will want that. Other people won't. And there's research that's shown, for example, that in a placebo-controlled trial where the active drug, it was in fact a heart drug, had side effects which gave you tummy upsets, that the tummy upsets became more common among people having the placebo who had been told that they might be getting the active drug than patients who weren't told about that. In other words, you can actually induce an expectation that people will experience adverse symptoms which they wouldn't have experienced had you not raised it with them.
So, if there's evidence to suggest that what you say to a patient can have both positive and negative placebo effects, then it's reasonable to wonder if we should exploit that. In modern medicine, after all, we assume that honesty, respecting our patient's autonomy and getting fully informed consent for treatment are all extremely important, and these principles certainly seem almost inviolable to me. But we should be aware that they may come at the cost of making treatments less effective. I wanted to know if I could provoke placebo researchers into justifying mild deception, overstating the benefits of a treatment perhaps, or underplaying the potential risks. Ted Kapchuk.
It's always wrong to deceive a patient. That probably does irrevocable harm in the short term and in the long term. I think that we have to walk a fine line. I think there are ways of explaining things and being optimistic that aren't deceitful. I think there are ways of being supportive in the doctor-patient relationship that probably could maximize the benefits of healthy context. My team's concern is that we wanted to quantify the benefits of the medical ritual because the medical community is resistant to actually implementing change unless they see numbers and quantification.
As Ted Kapchuk says, modern medicine requires that medical practice is informed, wherever possible, by good, solid evidence. But those who work outside the boundaries of evidence-based medicine may have no such qualms.
The lights are dim. Soothing music is played. The harmonizing effect of the treatment becomes evident. Gaylor and I walk amongst the patients, and by a touch of our hands, or of the wand I carry, increased power is carried to the affected parts. Gaylor has persuaded me to wear a purple gown to underline the solemnity and authority of my position as healer, as respect for the efficacy of the system is intrinsic to the cure.
In 18th century Vienna, Franz Anton Mesmer used animal magnetism to treat all kinds of medical problems, performing fabulous and melodramatic rituals on women who at the time would have been described as hysterical. His name is the origin of the word mesmerized, and despite a lack of evidence for his increasingly bizarre and grand theories, polite society was captivated by his charms. There are, perhaps, parallels with the sense of theatre and certainty offered by alternative medicine today. The New Age music and incense, but also simple things like longer consultations, long pseudo-scientific words and confident reassurance. Despite the lack of evidence showing that specific elements of most alternative therapies have any effect, many of them at least haven't been actively disproven. I wondered if this might give therapists the opportunity to make confident, reassuring claims to their patients, but without actively feeling as if they're misleading them. Professor George Lewith researches complementary medicine at Southampton University and also practices a range of complementary therapies himself.
If you're only spending the tiny, tiny amounts that we spend in the UK on complementary medical research, of course it's an evidence-free zone. That's just the way it is. So you can be legitimately honest with the patient and say, I don't know, but I've tried this before and sometimes it works. And that may be purely a placebo effect, but there's not much else you can do if that's your level of knowledge.
When a doctor gives a patient a treatment and they try to enhance the benefits by the way they give it, they're enhancing the benefits of a treatment which does have some specific effect.
Not always in primary care, but we hope quite a lot of the time.
Could you give me an example of a situation where that's not the case?
SSRIs in depression. A lot of them prescribed. Their specific effects have been called into doubt.
I would be always very clear that prescribing SSRI antidepressants for mild depression, for example, is a bad idea, because the evidence for benefit is very limited. Do you think it's acceptable, on the other hand, to prescribe a homeopathic sugar pill for mild depression, given that the evidence of benefit there is equivalently poor?
That's a difficult question. I think if you've got mild depression, very often the homeopathic consultation, in my experience, will be focusing on why the patient got depressed, what their overwhelming emotion is, how they might be thinking about managing that emotion, what kind of remedy picture that might fit, and that may give you other clues. And then you'll, at the end of your 35, 45 minutes, you'll make a symbolic gesture. You'll say, okay, well, I think at the moment we might be able to help you a little bit with this particular sugar pill for this particular reason. It's almost even shamanistic.
But you're giving them a pill and suggesting that the pill will help to make them better.
No, you're not. That's not what I've said. I think you need to be very clear that homeopathy is a package, and acupuncture may be a package as well.
But it seems to me that in the situation you describe, a patient has been reassured by a white lie. Now, I'm not sure what I think about that, but I'm interested in what you think about that.
I think it isn't a white lie if you're clear about the fact that you're not sure whether it's the process of homeopathy or the medicine that you give that works.
If the placebo effect is important, and I think it is, in treatment generally, part of its benefit comes from the trust that exists in the therapeutic relationship. And if you violate that trust, you're going to lose it. So physicians will lose part of what allows them to be effective as healers.
Irving Kirsch. It's an interesting idea that a short-term benefit could come at the long-term cost of a doctor's credibility. Perhaps we could give placebos openly, without deception. Edzard Ernst, professor of complementary medicine at Exeter University, doesn't think so.
Are you suggesting that we give these patients placebos, in which case we have to tell them, here's a placebo, explain what a placebo is, and sure enough it won't work? I'm, as a clinician, trained and as a person able to establish a good relationship, which then on the back of it can convey a placebo effect without being bogus.
But despite these admirable aspirations, there is some evidence that doctors do prescribe placebos, deliberately deceiving their patients. It's something that would make me very uncomfortable, but perhaps it's not always easy to hold the line, to be clear that antibiotics won't help a viral cold, to withhold a prescription when someone's demanding that you do something, anything involving a pill. A survey of Danish doctors found that around half had prescribed a placebo on more than 10 occasions, and some doctors are happy to take the issue head on.
I think the attitude of most people is, I don't care what it is or how it works. If it makes me feel better, bring it on.
Walter Brown is professor of clinical psychiatry at Brown University. He thinks there are situations where doctors should feel perfectly comfortable prescribing placebo pills, And more interestingly, he thinks this can be done without actively deceiving patients.
If clinicians think of placebos as broadly effective treatments that work better in some conditions than others, that we don't know the mechanisms of action, much like is the case with some other treatments, then they can be offered to patients quite honestly. I've written about this a little bit. You could tell people that, well, this herbal tea may help your hypertension or your depression, or you could take one of these capsules. They don't contain any medicine, but a lot of people improve when they take this. We don't know how this treatment works. It may stimulate the body's own healing processes, but whatever the way it works, a good number of people improve with this kind of treatment. I don't think that's deceptive.
It's not deceptive, I suppose, within the confines of that sentence, but of course somebody will be trusting that you as a doctor are saying that because there is an implicit understanding that what doctors say is founded in scientific research.
I think the statement that I made is founded in scientific research. You know, about 25% of people with mild to moderate hypertension get their blood pressure in the normal range with placebo treatment, as opposed to maybe 40 to 60% who do it with antihypertensive medication. The placebo response in mild to moderate depression is very close to the recovery rate that you get with antidepressants. I think when you say to people, look, you know, with the kind of depression you have, lots of people take antidepressant medicine and improve with it, and almost as many people can improve with this placebo tablet. I think that statement is based on evidence.
I mean, I'm very sympathetic to what you're saying, but the only thing that worries me is the notion of implicitly deceiving people. There's a worry that perhaps you open yourself up to criticisms of paternalism in saying, you know, well, I know what's best for my patients, and what's best for my patients is to tell them perhaps a white lie, what Plato might have called a noble myth, but it's in their interests.
I think in the way I framed it, to me, it doesn't sound like a lie. I mean, I think you're not saying this medicine is better than conventional treatment. You're saying a lot of people get better with it.
One thing that I find very striking looking at the placebo research is that it goes a long way beyond just the power being in the pill. It seems that there's a lot about the whole cultural meaning of a treatment, the expectations that we have, the way that they're presented. I wonder whether it's necessary even to have a pill for the kind of benefits that we're describing, whether binding it all up in a pill somehow is actually quite disempowering and can medicalize people's problems.
The people who are assigned to placebo treatment are getting much more than a capsule. Mm. They get all of the common elements of any treatment situation, which include going to a healing authority, a doctor, having all the rituals and symbols of healing, getting a diagnosis, getting a thorough evaluation, getting some kind of a plausible treatment, high expectations for improvement, you're getting a chance to verbalize your distress. All of those things contribute to the placebo effect. So there's much more involved than taking a pharmacologically inert capsule, but I think in Western cultures, the prescription pad and the pill are very, very powerful symbolic parts of the healing process.
The killer experimental finding, of course, would be to show that placebos are effective, even when they're openly and honestly prescribed. That study was published just this year, looking at children diagnosed with ADHD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Walter Brown again.
They took a group of kids with ADHD, determined what their ideal dose of a psychostimulant was, the actual treatment.
And that's something like Ritalin.
Like Ritalin or one of the amphetamines. And then they, in some kids, they kept them on their usual dose. In others, they reduced the dose by 50%, but added a placebo capsule. And they told both the parents and the kids that it was a placebo, it didn't have any drug, and they referred to it as a dose extender, which I thought was rather clever. And then in another group, they halved the dose of stimulant but did not provide a placebo. They found that the group that received the placebo and half the stimulant dose did just as fine as those kept on the full dose and better than the ones who had their stimulant dose half but didn't have a placebo substitution. Those kids actually had some symptom exacerbations and deterioration.
And we should be clear that this was done openly. The parents and the children both knew.
Both were told that they were going to get a placebo. They called it a placebo. They said it doesn't have any medicine in it. And they said they want to consider it a dose extender, something that'll make it possible to improve upon the dose you're getting.
And how did the parents and children feel about that?
The paper actually describes in great detail reactions of the parents. It mostly was, you know, hey, if this works and the kid has fewer side effects, it's fine. And by the way, that attitude is entirely consistent with many anecdotes of patients who've been in clinical trials, and when the trial was over, were told that they'd received placebo and said they want to continue receiving it because it helped them so much. And I think it's worth keeping in mind that most people really hold to the belief that synthetic substances, like drugs produced by pharmaceutical companies, are dangerous for you as opposed to natural substances, which aren't. That, of course, is absolute nonsense, but that is a very firmly held belief by a lot of people.
So if patients really are sympathetic to the idea of harnessing placebo effects in their treatment, why has medicine been so reluctant to embrace this? For Daniel Moorman, Professor of Anthropology at the University of Michigan, at least part of the problem lies in medicine's tendency to ghettoise the placebo effect, conceiving it as something which only applies to sugar pills or the placebo arm of clinical trials.
One of the things that happens when people talk about placebo effect is they sort of isolate all of those effects from the rest of medicine, and that's wrong. All of those effects are happening all the time in everyday medicine. They just are more obvious when we give people inert tablets or inert drugs because we know that we didn't give them a drug. So I refuse to use the term placebo effect. I think that it gets us thinking in exactly the wrong way about how medicine works, how healing occurs, how drugs change us and help us live more powerful and more effective lives.
In some respects, it's a tragedy that these effects are somehow walled off from the rest of medicine. Ian Chalmers agrees that these effects need to be taken more seriously.
If someone's on to a particular form of care which actually works through people's imagination, but it actually does work, it actually helps people overcome their symptoms, that's something very important to know. People have been shown in one study to recover faster from surgery if their window looks out on trees than if their window looks out on a brick wall. Now, these circumstances, these ways of consultation often make the difference between someone being restored to relative comfort with much reduced symptoms or not.
Of course, it's very hard to research or pin down the more non-specific aspects of healthcare, the environment in which care is delivered, the continuity of seeing one practitioner. And Ian Chalmers worries that this might make these factors dangerously easy to disregard.
The thing about the placebo effect is that you can't easily put it in a bottle and sell it. And people who have things to sell don't like the idea that alternatives which cost nothing or very little are just as good. So, you know, if a doctor spends an extra 5 minutes with someone so that they can understand better what is troubling them and responds in a sensitive way, and that has to compete with someone making completely outrageous claim for the usefulness of a drug in particular circumstances, let's say, then the resources that are available to promote the drug, particularly if it's an expensive one or one that applies to a very large population of sufferers, that's going to win hands down by comparison with general practitioners saying they would like a bit more time to spend with their patients than they're currently getting.
Giving adequate attention to these kinds of effects is always going to be difficult in the expensive business of health. It's also, at first glance, a challenge to evidence-based medicine, the modern obsession with numbers and algorithms. But in reality, as we've seen, the evidence itself shows that these other aspects of what happens in the consulting room between a doctor and a patient can have a huge impact on health outcomes. For Dan Moorman, we need to start from scratch with a fresh look at how we train our doctors.
Medical education is designed to simplify things, to focus on the physiology, and to ignore all the rest. In order for people to come to understand that, they would have to give up 4/5 of what they, quote, know, unquote, or think they know about how medicine works. They're not going to do that. People have too much invested in it.
It's interesting that you say doctors are resistant, because to a certain extent it's actually quite flattering to believe that it's the doctor who's playing a major role in the patient getting better.
Well, you know, for many of them, if all of a sudden Mrs. Jones not getting better was a function of the fact that he didn't talk to her right, that he didn't have the right bedside manner. That's the way physicians trivialize this sort of stuff. And that he was going to get sued because he was grumpy that day because he'd had a fight with his wife. That's the last thing he wants to hear. He just wants it to be the pill.
Over the last two programs, we've heard how the meaning and the context, even the ritual of treatment, can have a profound effect on the final outcome, the health of the patient. There's a tendency sometimes to see these kinds of things as woolly or optional extras, somehow external to medicine. But for those who like evidence-based practice, the evidence is here to justify a shift of emphasis. Ted Kapchuk has the final word.
I think that there's a belief in mainstream medicine that the most efficient, the most powerful, and the most scientifically correct way of treating illness is to define the condition as a specific disease and then target it with a specific drug that knocks it out or changes it or turns it upside down or rights it. And I think that belief system or ideology is very potent and powerful. But for many of the chronic illnesses that we have, we don't have knockout drugs that work with that kind of refinement and precision. And there's a way that we want to have those drugs. And of course, we all do. But until we have those drugs, which I think is a utopian dream to think that we'd have them for all conditions, I think the ideology of specificity and scientific precision sometimes clouds the need for the art of medicine.
And what kind of concrete changes would you expect to see in response to your experimental results in an ideal world?
I would hope that studies that my team has performed and other people's, if they get the same results, will influence healthcare policy to not trim the amount of time a patient receives from a doctor, will not devalue the doctor-patient relationship, will understand that it's not just handing a pill like you're throwing feed to a chicken in a chicken coop, but it's actually the pill, the medication, is part of an elaborate drama, and that drama has an impact on people's illness and health.
Now, I think the rise of mass production and machines in general has gone hand in hand with people's idea of disease as a defect. Some should be remedied the same way that you would fix a machine, tend to swap out the broken part. I tend to enjoy very good health and follow Ivan Illich's precepts to try and stay away from doctors and medical treatment as much as possible. I try not to take painkillers because pain means something and I want to try and understand it. Ivan Illich, of course, died from a cancerous tumour, which he refused to be operated upon, and smoked opium as a method of controlling the pain towards the end of his life. And he chose to write an essay about pain as his response to that experience. I think it's a moot point whether we're likely to have more disease in the years ahead. Physical circumstances are looking like they might be pretty tight. In the era of peak oil, things are going to get tighter in terms of material goods. Then again, America throws away half the food that it's produced anyway. Mentally, things could be very much improved. The same way in which you can get used to a smelly environment so you don't notice the smell until you go somewhere clean, I think we've gotten used to stress. We've internalized it, we're running on cortisol, and we're not consuming food properly, coming down with illnesses. Is this the way that we should be living? I'm wondering what we should be doing with December the 21st, actually. People have been talking about, oh, that's going to be an important day. Maybe we can make it the end of the world as we know it, and the beginning of something better. How about if an online petition to not pay rent, mortgages, or interest on loans was circulated, and 500 million people said, yeah, we'll go for that. If you got any thoughts along those lines, any memes you want to put out there, send me an email. This and 589 other episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive.
There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for any discussion relevant to the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.